Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Indigenous enslavement predated the African slave trade. And while European colonists were quick to take slaves from the Americas, indigenous people enslaved each other before the colonists arrived. Slavery of Native Americans is not well known or understood, but it is an important part of our history to explore. The National Museum of the American Indian sponsored a symposium to examine the issue. We'll learn more about the indigenous slave trade this hour. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Lauren King to be U.S. District Court Judge for Western Washington. King will become the first Native American federal judge in Washington state's history. Here's U.S. Senator Patty Murray from Washington on C-SPAN speaking on the Senate floor.
Ms. King is an immensely talented and experienced practitioner of the law who I had the honor of recommending to the president for this position, and I am proud to be advocating for her confirmation here today. Ms. King currently chairs Foster Garvey's Native American Law Practice Group and has served as a pro tem appellate judge for the Northwest Intertribal Court System since 2013. She has served as a commissioner on the Washington State Gambling Commission and taught federal Indian law at Seattle University School of Law.
King, a citizen of the Muskogee Nation, will become the fourth Native American federal judge currently in the country and sixth in history.
So it's not just important, but essential that our federal judges understand the unique histories and perspectives of Native people and the legal principles that protect and preserve Native American standing under federal law. I believe this is a perspective that matters and one that has been missing for far too long. With her experience in the Northwest Intertribal Court System and representing tribes in private practice, Ms. King has a deep understanding of these principles and the legal issues that tribes in Washington state face.
The Senate voted to confirm King 55-44 on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, President Biden announced his intent to nominate Shelley Lowe as chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. A citizen of the Navajo Nation, she's currently a member of the National Council on the Humanities, an advisory board for the endowment. Her career in higher education includes positions at Yale, Harvard, the University of Arizona, and has served in various leadership roles. The National Endowment for the Humanities supports research and learning in history, literature, philosophy, and other areas. The Navajo Nation Council has passed legislation requiring all government employees across the reservation to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the legislation also presses schools and all Navajo-owned businesses to adopt similar vaccine requirements.
The council's bill mandates all workers within the tribe's legislative, executive, and judicial branches, along with employees of local chapters, to receive all their shots by later this month. Workers who aren't fully vaccinated will be required to present proof of a negative COVID test every 2 weeks. Violations of the bill's requirements could be followed with disciplinary measures. The legislation was passed by the council in a late August special session. It was then sent to Navajo Nation President Jonathan Ned, who neither signed nor vetoed it, allowing the bill to go into effect. According to Nez's office, the council's legislation reaffirms an executive order he had previously issued that also required all tribal employees to get vaccinated by the end of September. Within the Navajo executive branch, at least 85% of employees have so far been fully vaccinated. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a legislative hearing Wednesday on Indian water rights settlement bills. Witnesses include tribal leaders from the Shoshone Paiute tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation and the Fort Belknap Indian community. Witnesses from the Interior Department are the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs and a regional director with the Bureau of Reclamation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Next.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Come Unity, Environment is Sacred is a series of on-demand films portraying a Native revolution to environmentally align with nature in celebration of International Earth Day. Available through April 30th at visionmakermedia.org, who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Slavery is one of the most egregious episodes in America's history. And indigenous people were among both the oppressed and oppressors before and after contact with European settlers. How slavery affected Native Americans is poorly documented, but some historians are working to gain a better understanding. It's clear that Spanish settlers enslaved members of America's indigenous populations well before the African slave trade. And it wasn't long before it was standard practice throughout Europe. But slavery was also incorporated in the early American colonies and beyond. Today, we'll hear more about the history and reverberations of indigenous slavery. We also want to hear from you. What do you know about slavery and Native Americans? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Joining us today, from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Dr. Patricia Trujillo. She's an associate professor at Northern New Mexico College and literary scholar of New Mexico history and culture. She's Chicana. Welcome to Native America Calling, Patricia.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Really excited to start the discussion today. So, how much do we know about slavery involving indigenous people, Patricia?
In northern New Mexico, and coming from, you know, I am born and raised in northern New Mexico. We always say in New Mexico, you have to say where you're from and who your people are, right? My mom was born in El Huache, New Mexico, which is one of the first Hispano communities on the Yunque side of the Okeowingue land grant, which is the Hispano side. And my dad is from Taos. And so what I know and what I know in my community is that the story of Indian slavery is one that is very much a part of our oral tradition. It's a part of our family canons and really has a ubiquitous presence within our families and communities. And so what has always been interesting for me as a scholar of New Mexico history is that there was always this sense of knowing that, and there was always the coded language, right, of cautivos, criadas, and knowing that at different parts of our family history, unfortunately, that there were criados and criadas in our families, our ancestors' households, and that also some of our family members had been taken. And that's a very common story amongst of what we say manito and manita, which is how we call ourselves in northern New Mexico, in manito and manita families. So it was very common hearing that growing up. But then as I became more and more involved in scholarly work in New Mexico, especially in literature, is that what I was finding is that it was not being studied very much until recently. And now we see that there is a subdiscipline, a discipline of what is being called Genizado studies, which is all about studying Indian slavery in New Mexico and in relationship to the greater Southwest.
That's interesting. So why do you think that is, that this history, so much of it has just been not spoken about or not referred to at all for so many generations, centuries, really?
Yeah. I was saying, in the community it is, but again, in academic study, it was not so much. And so I think that there was definitely this sense of politics that came involved about how Nuevo Mexicanos, had a long territorial period, had a real challenge in becoming U.S. citizens. There's all of the complexities of that. And I think that throughout those generations of identity formation in relation to the nation state, that as people were being forced into this more, I would say, like cookie cutter American identity, the more we were forced to really silence a lot of those other narratives. And so oftentimes you have like that like model citizenry kind of perspective. And there's a lot of tensions about that within our own communities. And so I think that's one aspect of it. I also think that in regards to, again, in the study of literature, trying to find those representations, there are a few. I would point to Fabiola Cabeza de Vaca Gilbert's work in the 1940s. It's called The Good Life. And she actually has a cautiva character, Doña Senia, who is a big part of the storytelling in that collection of stories. And then we also have Fray Angelico Chavez, of course, who was writing in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond, who was also making it known. But that literature was very regional. And so it is only like now more in the contemporary study that we're seeing more and more representations, and I would say more and more accurate representations of Indian captivity in New Mexico.
When people think of slavery in the United States, or what was even before it was the United States in the North American continent, we often think of the South and slavery of African Americans, and we have images of what we think that looked like. Did slavery look similar in the Southwestern United States?
I think there are several different permutations. It's interesting. I'm actually coming to you from the Santa Fe Convention Center because I'm at a meeting here. But I'm sitting in a room, and there's literally like a statue of de Vargas on the side of me. And the rooms, of course, have the names of colonizers all around me. And I think, of course, of the cathedral here that was actually built. And many Indian captives, Indian slaves, were used to build that structure that's so, iconic and part of Santa Fe's landscape. And so anywhere that we look, you know, even as the earliest colonists came into what we now understand to be New Mexico, they were bringing indigenous slaves to Mexico. So here in Santa Fe, that was the Tlaxcaltecans. I'm sorry, I have a hard time saying that. and one of the oldest neighborhoods here, the Barrio Analco, was where those indigenous slaves lived and eventually built a community for themselves. In the mid-1700s, detribalized Native people, many who had been held as slaves and many who would be sold as slaves into the future, created communities across New Mexico as part of Spanish land grants and frontier communities known as Genizado communities. In those land grants, the Spanish crown basically brought folks, Native folks who had been detribalized from several different tribes. But as part of the agreement within the land grants, they basically agreed to live by Spanish custom and mores. To protect that frontier community of the Spanish Empire. So there's a lot of complexity in regards to the different permutations of what slavery and indentured servitude look like in northern New Mexico, because also there was the part where there was just, you know, intertribal, intercommunity conflict. And, you know, the stories that I grew up with, fortunately, I knew my great-grandmother well into my life, and she was born in 1886. And she would tell us stories where she still recalled, you know, hiding from the nomadic tribes, so like Comanches, alongside with Pueblo neighbors, and when she was a little girl. And so there was this sense that there was fear, you know, between and amongst tribal communities and Hispano communities. But then also, you know, there were times where Hispano communities, Pueblo communities would ally themselves against nomadic tribes. And so for those of us who are descendants of either whether it was through conflict or at different points in history, intermarriage, our identities are very complex in regards to thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be a descendant of Indian slaves in 2021. And I think that was part of this greater project from the Smithsonian. We had a lot of wonderful conversations about it, but I'm really glad to be a part of the ongoing scholarship that is getting us to engage in it in really deep ways.
When we think of slavery in the Americas, amongst indigenous peoples, it's very easy to make the assumption that these are only, were only European countries that were engaged in that practice. Did native people also take slaves?
From my understanding, yes. And so that was intertribal. So between and amongst, you know, again, like the nomadic tribes and the more sedentary settled tribes. And then also there is a lot of, how do I say, there is also evidence, sorry, my brain went blank, of tribal folks also taking children from Hispano villages. So for me, that becomes of interest of how that is depicted in literature. And what becomes really significant is that two of the novels that I am currently exploring are young adult novels. And one is actually a mass market paperback through the American Girl Company, and the character or the doll, Josefina Montoya. And there is a book called A Mystery in the Hills, and it uses the folktale of La Llorona to basically tell the story of an elder criada, a woman who has been taken into servitude, and a younger woman. And in that novel, there is definitely this cross-cultural conversation of the older woman is an Hispana who had been taken, and the younger girl, I'm sorry, no, the older woman is a native woman who had been taken, and the younger girl is an Hispana. And they actually find healing with one another in being able to talk about their shared experience. But for me, it's really interesting that in this contemporary moment that we know, where we're having a lot of very honest racial reckonings, really honest conversations about telling accurate history, even if more difficult than what we had been told in the past, that there are now tools to be able to have these conversations with younger folks.
Patricia, this is a fascinating history and so eye-opening to many people. Again, I think so many of us have a very narrow view of what slavery looked like and who was involved in slavery and what part of the United States, what is present-day United States, where slavery occurred. And apparently, slavery occurred in many, many parts of the United States, and many people were involved with that process. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Native people have traditional aquaculture methods they've always practiced. Now, new modern advances in markets are opening the door to sustainable economic development opportunities for tribes. We'll find out about the growing potential for tribal aquaculture programs on the next Native America Calling.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential Act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE, support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Do you know about slavery and Native Americans? It's sometimes referred to as the other slavery, and it had a far-reaching and profound impact on many tribes. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Joining us from Tucson, Arizona, is Dr. Erica Pettis. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Arizona. Welcome to Native America Calling, Erica.
Thank you very much. I appreciate joining you today.
Now, Erica, we've talked about indigenous slavery in New Mexico, specifically northern New Mexico. However, slavery, indigenous slavery, also existed in California. What is the connection between Native slaves and Spanish missions in present-day California?
Yes, I think it would be helpful for all of us to kind of reframe our thinking about what slavery means, because I do believe that our vision or our, you know, the kinds of memories or thoughts that get associated with slavery is very much about the African-American experience in this country. But if we look at the Spanish period and the Mexican period that would follow in Alta California, which is, you know, present-day California, we know that Native peoples, their bodies, their labor was instrumental in the construction of missions and the mission chain up and down the coastline of California. And without their labor, those missions would not have survived and endured. And so Spanish missionaries, specifically the Franciscans, who was led by Junipero Serra and then later on by Francisco de Lasuen, they were in charge of making sure that the missions functioned, that there were crops growing that would help support the ability of the missions to continue. And when indigenous peoples go to the missions, you know, often they are going for a variety of reasons. Some of them are in distress because of various impact on their natural habitat, on their food stuff, because of the arrival of the Spanish. The Spanish introduce a lot of kind of competitive, hostile grasses, flora, fauna that is going to do some damage to some of the native foodways. And so Native people sometimes would go to the missions in search of sustenance or food. Sometimes they were naturally curious about some of the pageantry and rituals that they may have witnessed, but they were also definitely under a coercive system because of the violence that was enacted by Spanish-Mexican soldiers. And so once Native peoples entered the mission system and became baptized, they were basically viewed as Catholics for life. And if they decided to leave the mission, run away from the mission without permission, because they had to get permission to leave, if they decided to leave, it was not uncommon for raids to take place led by Spanish-Mexican soldiers to go and retrieve those runaways and bring them back to the mission. And so in that sense, their freedom, their self-autonomy, their ability to move throughout their homeland is severely curtailed, and their family formation is limited because they are sometimes not able to, you know, foster those networks and those contacts with other villages or outlying communities that maybe surrounded those missions. So there is this, you know, deprivation of your own body and your own ability to move, and that's something that I don't think we really understand a lot in the early history of the Americas, is the ways in which different colonizing forces enacted slavery in different ways.
My understanding is that because Spain occupied the Southwest in parts of California, of course, these were some of the richest and most densely populated areas of the Americas. And coincidentally, they also did not have any African colonies. So they were in this position where they could exploit these native peoples in a way that other European countries didn't have access. But we've been talking a lot about Spain today. What other European countries were engaged in taking slaves from America?
Well, we know France was engaged in that, and this is not in California, but we do have extensive information about how in the period of colonization in what we would consider today the Canadian borderlands of New France, the Great Lakes region, the St. Lawrence River Valley region, you know, there was captivity and enslavement practices taking place. There was a global network of enslaved indigenous peoples who were circulated across the North American continent and going even into the Caribbean. And, you know, kind of cycling back up, we had Arawak peoples and other peoples from South America who are sent to North America. So there is an extensive global network of trafficking of indigenous peoples that is often left out of a lot of the histories. And I think one of the reasons for this has to do with perhaps the language of certain sources in which this information is written. So, you know, if you are not well-versed in French, for example, if you are not well-versed in Spanish, you're going to get a very skewed history about enslavement in North America. And since there is a lot of emphasis on English language sources in American history, that does tend to skew our understanding of enslavement practices.
For how long were Native peoples in the Americas subjected to slavery, and when did it finally end?
Well, I mean, that's difficult to say in terms of when it finally ended. Certainly in my research, the binding out of indigenous children, their bodies, you know, tearing them away from families is something that continued well into the late 1800s. We had American laws being passed after the U.S.-Mexico War ended, which really just kind of enacted practices that were already in existence at the time under Mexican rule and Spanish rule before that. So, for example, vagrancy laws was a mechanism by which indigenous peoples would be rounded up if they were thought to be loitering in downtown L.A. or if they were thought to be loitering in the countryside, didn't seem to have a set place where they resided, or they didn't seem to have a noticeable form of employment. Indigenous peoples could get rounded up and even auctioned off. And so this is something that did take place in that transition between the Mexican and the American period. And then we had a series of amendments and acts that were passed in California. And again, this is in around the 1850 to 1863 time period that were for binding out indigenous children as apprentices or servants. And this just perpetuated a practice that already existed among Spanish-Mexican settlers who would take captive children and put them into their households to work as domestic servants or to work as ranching labor. And you have generations of indigenous peoples who are living on those California ranchos as laborers. And the testimony of one Dominguez family descendant, he talked about how he witnessed on his family's rancho, generations of indigenous peoples being born there and dying there, and that he thought it was the closest thing to slavery he had ever seen. And this is in the late 1800s, mind you. So this is something that continued. And if we think about the ways in which Native children today are still subjected to being taken from their communities and adopted out into non-Native families, I mean, the argument could be made that this is something, although it's not enslavement in the way that we think of it in the 19th century, the fact that Native communities and families are their autonomy, their self-determination in terms of family, community is constantly interrupted. I think the argument could be made that those practices are still happening.
Let's bring our audience into the conversation. We have Jason. He's listening online in Houston, Texas. Jason, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much. I currently live and work in Houston, Texas, but I was born and raised in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm actually Hispanic through my mother's side, and I found this a very interesting. I've listened to Native American Call on at work, and when this topic came up, it's definitely one of my interests looking into, because when I got my master's degree, my concentration was on Hispanics in the American Southwest. And that doesn't deal with the acculturation and assimilation of the indigenous groups under Spanish colonization. And coming across my readings of historical scholarly peer-reviewed books is the other side of Indian enslavement also happens amongst indigenous groups themselves. And I know that scholars have uncovered where, say, the Utes would raid the lesser tribes like the Paiutes, bring them down to Abiquiu, and sell them off at the Spanish fairs, as well as the Comanches would do the same thing. You know, they were, you know, raid Pueblo towns, Apaches, bring them into Taos, and also sell them at Spanish fairs. And, you know, this is also happening down around in the Yucatan, in Mexico City, where enslavement was happening, where they would capture others and sell them for various reasons. And that's something I want to bring in that I've uncovered in my own research of going through to learn more about my own Hispanic heritage. And then Dr. Trujillo touched on something that was very interesting, talking about the French. I remember reading Gerald Horn's book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, and the English were also involved in the New England area, the Mid-Atlantic states, where they would capture the indigenous groups there and then sell to the pirates that were operating from the Barbary Coast. From there, they would enter into the Turkish slave market. So the English were involved with that along with the French. And so that's the reason why I was just calling in, kind of contribute to this discussion that, you know, European nations were involved with this, but also indigenous groups were also involved in enslaving other indigenous groups. And, you know, thank you so much for letting me be able to speak on this subject.
Absolutely, Jason. And we really appreciate those comments. And certainly a lot of Native groups were also involved in slavery, which creates a lot of just very difficult conversations and just dynamics that we have to consider with this whole issue. We've got another caller on the line. We've got Jay, and he's listening on KUNM in Albuquerque. Jay, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, everyone, and thank you for allowing me to contribute to the discussion. I've been listening, and certainly it's something unique and something we should be talking about, especially after those two articles, the 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah Jones, as well as the book that came out called Test, certainly, and then also another book called The Other Slavery by Andres Renzendez. However, the two points I want to bring out is, number one, as a construct, slavery is really a human issue. Slavery has been obviously on both sides of our planet. Even before Christianity was an idea, Egyptian-type slaves, the Roman-type slaves, the Greek-type slaves, many Native groups had slaves. So it's really just a human bad behavior. Something allows humans to say to another group, I don't think of you the same value as I think of myself and maybe my group, and therefore I can have the right to force you to do things that I wouldn't do myself. That's that basic construct that humans have always had. However, the other part I want to bring up is that what changed significantly beginning in the late 1500s was that now slavery became institutionalized. This was completed by the Catholic Church, beginning with some of the earliest papal bulls, which then allowed and justified as well as sanctioned and indemnified someone else to be taken into slavery and be absolved of the fact that they were taking another human being and enslaving them. And so those are certainly Native groups that have suffered under slavery, both by their other indigenous neighbors. But what had significantly changed was once that hybridization or that marriaging between a sovereign state, in basically with the kingdoms of Portugal and the kingdoms of Spain and other European countries or monarchies at the time, then justified through the Catholic Church, was now it became that I could feel that, or a person could enslave another person and then certainly be justified and absolved of whatever I was doing. And then on top of that was a written document that was published in 15.
Jay, I'm going to go ahead and go back to our guests on the call. Appreciate those comments, though. So what we're hearing from some of these callers is that this is so many people involved in different indigenous groups as well. So I'd like to ask Erica, what are your thoughts about these complexities with, you know, Native people being involved in the slave trades as well as Europeans? Is there any way to kind of make light or come to some kind of a summary or conclusion of what that really means?
Well, certainly I think if we look at it on Native terms, indigenous people's terms, slavery had a different meaning and implementation than it did in European hands. There were mechanisms by which those who were taken captive or those who were, gifted as captives. There were mechanisms by which those individuals could become acculturated and incorporated into the new nation, the new tribe, right? In which case they could become members of the community to a certain extent, especially if you're a woman who could perhaps reproduce within the tribe that you have now been taken by. And I think that's different than, say, the kinds of mechanisms that Europeans would implement through these kinds of legal codes, the depriving of human liberties and rights. You know, there's just some differences there that I think we need to appreciate. And so in terms of indigenous practices, we can't judge folks who were engaged in those kinds of practices with this kind of 2021 lens, whereby they would have known the ramifications in terms of long-term effects of these kinds of practices of taking captives or trafficking peoples. You know, just like African peoples were a part of the slave trade in taking captives, it doesn't mean that they had this understanding on a long mirror or long lens of history as to how that was going to affect their peoples. Instead, we have to remember that this is very localized. You know, sometimes rivalries among peoples plays out in these kinds of practices. And so, you know, that needs to be distinguished, that kind of nuance. And so there were mechanisms by which people could kind of become acculturated within the new group. In other instances, maybe not. But nevertheless, I think it's important to distinguish between Native practices and ways of thinking about slavery from European practices.
We're going to have to take a quick break. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848, to contribute to the discussion. I'm Sean Spruce.
As tribal leaders, we know we need to protect our elders, but it isn't always apparent what harms them. Some of our elders feel socially isolated or lonely. The more we are socially connected with our family and community, the less health problems we will have and the longer we will live. As tribal leaders, we can also create programs to help our elders. Connected Together, we'll stand strong. More on elder isolation and caregiver resources at ConnectedIndigenousElders.org. The National Indian Council on Aging supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. It can be a touchy topic, Native Americans and slavery, but it's an important part of our history that provides context for everything that came after. Joining us from Española, New Mexico, is Dr. Roylene Ross. She's a cultural psychologist, and she is from Laguna Pueblo. Welcome to Native America Calling, Dr. Ross.
Thank you for having me today.
So, talking about all of these issues around slavery, and I want to put this into a present-day context. How is this kind of trauma passed on to generations today amongst our Native communities?
Let me start by saying, going back to the iconic church in Santa Fe, using that example, intergenerational trauma is carried through generations in ways that, you know, the church, let's take that for example, in Santa Fe, it was built over a Pueblo Kiva, as our oral tradition tells us, our oral history. And our oral history is told in a very different way. Today, I would say that our history is being rewritten in our own Native voices and countering the historical voices that have told our story. We are now telling our own story and telling history from a different perspective because of, you know, I've not found any literature that cites that church was built over a Pueblo Kiva, which, of course, is a sacred place of worship for our Pueblo people here. Capturing this knowledge from a Native perspective is helping to equalize our historical, you know, narrative. And it stops and or seeks to stop the perpetuation of the stereotypes of our Native people. The intergenerational trauma has resulted today, I may clinical psychologist by training has resulted in what many of our behavior health, mental health agencies are dealing with today. You know, the suicide rate in our Native population, how all of the intergenerational harms and trauma have impacted our cultural identity, you know, the cultural and religious genocide through slavery and bondage, what that has created and has led in part to our social and medical maladies, including our incarceration rate. You know, our Native males are four times more likely to be incarcerated and or arrested than other ethnic populations. You know, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, that has resulted in Native people being viewed as less than human or being viewed as savages. Therefore, we don't matter, resulting in the loss, this crisis of our missing and murdered Native women. We also, you know, if you go and look at, you know, the medical maladies, you look at the diabetes rates and how that has impacted our future or our current generation. You think about the stress, and acculturation stress is real. And assimilation, all these years of colonization. And looking at, you know, right now, one of the ways people are measured is through their adverse childhood experiences. And when that's applied to Native people, although it wasn't normed on a Native population, Native people are being subjected to, you know, the outcomes. This is what this says about you. If you score 10 out of 10 on ACEs, basically you're doomed, which is not true. Native people have this resilience about them, of them, in them. There's studies on epigenetics that we carry this trauma in our DNA, but we also carry the resilience as well in our DNA. So the effects are real. Many times, you know, people say, well, get over it. You know, get over the history. This is 2021. Why are you bringing this up? Because it is still very relevant today. I believe Dr. Pettis talked about boarding schools that, you know, forced servitude into the 1950s. And many of our grandparents in our generation currently were servants of non-Native families in different parts of the country. So it is very much a part of our being and who we are today. And so one of the movements in mental health, the behavioral health field, is to include culture as a healing mechanism in the treatment plans, in the therapy, in the interventions, because culture has been our medicine since time immemorial.
Speaking as a mental health professional, is it important that we teach our young in households and in our Native communities about this legacy of slavery? And if so, how do we approach it?
So talking about negative things, talking about things such as suicide, talking about the genocide, you know, that was that our people were subjected to, talking about, you know, our religion and why we've had to take it underground for protection. Having those conversations is a part of the healing journey. Having those conversations, the reality of, you know, what happened to 1, 2, 3, 4 generations ago can be a healing mechanism, because the truth versus how American history is told in all of our public education settings, it's told in one voice, and it doesn't include the Native voice about history. And so bringing out the truth with our young and educating them on how this can affect or impact a person's life is healing, and giving and providing the truth from a truthful perspective, from our oral tradition and our oral history, and going back to our creation stories. I work here at 8 Northern Indian Pueblos Council, and our executive director talks about living our creation stories. So that is also a healing mechanism with our communities, with our families, with our children.
Let's go to the phones. We have Melvin calling in from Santee, Nebraska, listening on KZYK. Melvin, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. I was glad the lady there was talking about modern day. You know, my grandpa and them all went to Genoa boarding school here in Nebraska. And when I was young, I said, what did you do at that school? He said, work. He said, we used to go in trucks to these small little towns around us, not only Genoa, but West Point, some of these other little farm towns. And they dug out, they're the ones that put in their infrastructure, water lines, sewer lines, that, you know, trenches had to be dug. Kind of like that movie, Shawshank Redemption. But it was our kids that were doing that labor in these boarding schools. And, you know, that quit in the late 50s, 60s, maybe, that type of labor. But we were still doing the cornfields, you know, in the 60s. You know, for farmers. But slavery didn't end, you know, when we thought back in 1800s with the Emancipation Proclamation, whatever. It did end there. And I'm glad she brought that up. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Melvin. And my grandparents used to tell similar stories. They went to Albuquerque Indian School, and I know they did a lot of work there as well. Those Indian schools were farms, they were cattle ranches, and those kids were charged with fixing all those meals and harvesting all those crops. It was a lot of work. So going back to Roylene, that's all part of this whole discussion as well, as the servitudinal nature of many of these boarding schools. Could you comment on that?
That was in part what I had alluded to. You know, into the 50s, into the 60s, there's a Presbyterian school in Albuquerque, a private school, and it started out as a boarding school for Native children, again, going back to the boarding school era. However, you know, into the 1980s, as a part of tuition, you know, the students, Native students included, but many students were also from small Hispanic communities in New Mexico. That was a part of the tuition, was, you know, going out and working in the kitchen, while working out on the school grounds, things of that nature. So that was a very, very, it was continued. You know, it had continued into the late, you know, 20th century. So that did not change. One thing that I also wanted to just state is that, you know, in our history, you know, there was sterilization of our women, you know, at Indian Health Service hospitals across our country, and those are documented, but we don't hear much about that in our American history. The loss of our cultural identity, our language, those things occurred, you know, there at boarding school. The purpose of boarding school was for assimilation, to assimilate Native kids into American society. Those are still very real in our school systems today. Language, English, you know, English only in our schools, and that perpetuates what happens to our children who are, you know, bilingual, with their native tongue being their first language, which we have in our Native communities here in New Mexico. What about that still being perpetuated today, and the non-acceptance of, you know, the the difficulties that school systems make on our bilingual kids? What about our school governance? How many Native parents and or Native community members do we have on our public school boards? Very few, very minimal. Therefore, the direction of our school systems are still subjected to dominant society rules, policies, governance. And so that's still very real today. If it could go on, it could, be a dissertation unto itself to continue this conversation, but those are some of the high points. I just also want to say that here at Northern Native Pueblos Council, we are beginning the journey of equalizing and inserting our Native traditional values into a Western modeled behavior health system, into service delivery, into things of that nature, for the purpose of serving the Native community with services that are culturally relevant.
We have time for one more question, and I'd like to put this issue back into a historical context, and I'd like to go to Patricia. When the United States Congress passed the 13th Amendment, it prohibited both slavery and involuntary servitude, and that presented an opportunity to liberate all Native Americans held in bondage in the West. But that didn't happen. Why was that?
Gosh, that's a huge question. And I see how I am really appreciating Dr. Pettis and Dr. Ross's perspectives of how complex it is and embedded in other political systems. So where my mind immediately went is that, a Native man by the name of Trujillo in New Mexico actually has to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get voting rights for Native Americans in the 1940s, right? Much later than the 13th Amendment. And so there are ways that we understand that policy laws come together piecemeal. And so even to connect to the caller from Santee, I actually went to the University of Nebraska, and one of my best friends from grad school is from Santee. And we would always talk about how our grandmothers, even though, she was from the reservation in Nebraska, and my grandmother was, Hispana from northern New Mexico, it was the Spanish, it was the normal school, so the Spanish-American normal school in northern New Mexico, and for her, the Santee normal school, that was really the model for Americanization at that time, assimilation, that they would bring Hispano and Native people, wherever they were regionally or geographically, Americanize them, make them teachers, and then that connects to how Dr. Ross was saying that school systems now really embed, that bias and racism against Indigenous people. And so it's so hard to understand that, that my grandmother, I know that her story was that she did have to work to afford her boarding school tuition at the Spanish American Normal School. And then to now be having these conversations, right? There's that bittersweetness that as her granddaughter, I get to continue that legacy of education and decolonization and having these amazing kinds of conversations. And also knowing the pain that she went through, as in from the Hispano perspective of having her language and her culture stripped at those very schools.
Folks, that's all we have time for today. Fabulous discussion. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Patricia Trujillo, Dr. Erica Pettis, and Dr. Roylene Ross. This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting Youth in Action, Indigenous Peoples Day, Black Indigenous Youth Advancing Social Justice, a virtual program that highlights youth of blended Black and Native heritage who use art, activism, and policy to advance Black and Indigenous solidarity and effect positive change in their communities. Available on October 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at americanindian.si.edu.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.